Welcome. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. So I'm going to start with our magazine about memory, The Complete Guide to Memory. This is by Centennial Health. And the chapter that we're going to deal with today is called Sentimental Journey. The sense of smell triggers profound memories of childhood and helps to cement an event or interlude in the brain forever. The fragrance of a flower that grew in your childhood garden can bring back memories of days spent by the pool with iced tea, inner tubes, and your first best friend. Your sense of smell is particularly powerful in calling up emotional scenes from the past because the olfactory nerve has a main line to memory centers in the brain. And a little side item here, the great French novelist and essayist Marcel Proust is best known for the 7-volume masterwork In Search of Lost Time, a fictionalized recollection of his life. So let's move on to the article. We probably won't get through the whole thing today, but we will continue it next time. The smell of cut grass evokes for many of us the memory of a childhood summer or many happy summers merged, siblings and first cousins running on lawns at family gatherings, the smell of potato clay turning to dust, the small grocery shop on Main Street, Port Arlington, the sawdust and warm rosin smell of newly cut wood, a Saturday morning in the hardware shop with my father, the heavy sour smell of a creamery, getting the country butter on Friday in the co-op on Green Street. In these memories, we can often see ourselves as we were then. Marcel Proust's description of the immediacy and purity of the memory associated with the taste and smell of a madeleine, a small sponge cake, is famous and perhaps over-referenced, but as a classic, it is worth quoting again. But when, from a long distance past, nothing subsists, after the people are dead, after the things are broken and scattered, taste and smell alone, more fragile, but more enduring, more immaterial, more persistent, more faithful, remain poised for a long time, like souls, remembering, waiting, hoping, amid the ruins of all the rest, and there unflinchingly, in the tiny and almost impalpable drop of their essence, the vast structure of recollection. He describes what we have all probably experienced at some time in our lives. We taste or smell something, and we immediately feel the emotion associated with the memory of the fragrance or the flavor. Smell and taste are interpreted in overlapping areas of the brain's cortex, but smell is the more immediate trigger for emotional memories. The experience of a vivid emotional memory being triggered by smell, wrapping you in your own mystery, is known as the Proustian effect. Each of us experience our own personal moments, and literature is full of these arresting memories. The Irish novelist John Banville has written of one such experience, albeit with a flowering plant rather than food. Lupins are for me what the madeleine was to Proust. When he catches the smell of a lupin, time falls away and I am a child again. He hears the sound of the sea, feels the sting of salt on sunburned skin, tastes banana sandwiches, and smells that mingled smell of crushed grass, seaweed, night soil, and cows. Smell is the most mysterious, soulful, delicate, and the most intrinsically emotional of our senses, woven with sensations through our biographical memory to form a sixth sense. During the days of my first consultant post in Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, England, I, for one, had a visceral experience that I will never forget, which I will now recount. The smell of lovage. It was the warm, sunny summer of 1995, and I was in the early months of my first pregnancy. We had bought a 300-year-old house with a garden so big that the back boundary was not visible to the eye from the kitchen door. If, that summer, you had followed the parched lawn down past the big oak tree and then the orchard, you would have entered an undergrowth with a thick smell of earth compost mixed with hot river vapor before seeing the river that marked the back boundary. The hot air, as stagnant as the shrunken river, had trapped spinning clouds of small river insects, the mesmerizing, unending sounds of the invisible crickets, possibly grasshoppers, extended into mellow firmament as if sound was also trapped. I found myself in a mood similar to the weather, suspended and absorbed by nature. I spent a lot of my time that summer in the herb garden, laid out among flagstones by the back door. Most of the herbs had been planted by previous owners, and I spent weekends over months restoring it, weeding out ivy, mint, and lemon verbena, and cutting back the lavenders and thymes that had gone to wood. I was also learning to use the garden herbs in cooking. One day during this lovely summer, I picked a bunch of herbs to flavor a salad. Although I had daily morning sickness, I was always well by evening, except for that night when the nausea returned with a vengeance. The next morning, I was more than usually sick and remember having to lie down on the wiry carpet tiles in my office between consultations to close my eyes for 1 or 2 minutes before facing the next anxiously awaiting patient. Unable to identify what had made me ill, I felt that it was something in the green salad that had brought it on and decided that greens were out of my diet for the remainder of the pregnancy. Some days later, while working in the herb garden, I bent down and inadvertently, smelling a plant, felt a jolt of nausea. Looking around to identify the source of the smell, I saw a tall, luscious green plant with yellow clusters of flowers that I instantly identified as the culprit in my sickness of the previous week. It was lovage, an ancient plant grown in convents and monasteries around Europe, used then extensively in cooking and in herbal remedies. It was puzzling that it had made me sick. Lovage was not harmful. Perhaps I had misidentified the plant or misremembered what I had read about it. I consulted my herb books, only to discover, in a hidden-away paragraph, that lovage should not be consumed during pregnancy. Centuries ago, lovage had been used to induce abortion. Thankfully, I had eaten a few, very few leaves at most. The olfactory alarm. I began to wonder whether other foods that I had identified as making me sick were also potentially toxic to the pregnancy. That is not a question that I can answer, but I can explain how my brain knew that lovage was the culprit. There was the initial sensory recording of the smell and the taste of the lovage, followed by the formation of a memory of this sensation, otherwise I would not have recognized it, and then reactivation of the memory on re-smelling the lovage some days later. That smell brought with it, incredibly, a sense of the sickness that the herb had caused when I ate it. All this had happened before the visual identification of the lovage. It was as if the olfactory memory of the lovage had paused, ready and waiting to be ignited if smelled or tasted again, to warn me of its poisonous consequences. A smell may cause a range of feelings, those of the vanished loveliness of childhood, as the author William Styron put it, of love, a baby's scalp, of sexual excitement, a lover's neck, of fear, rancid sweat, of disgust, rotting fish, or in my case, lovage. Smell brings you back in time and warns you about the future in the blinking of an eye. How does smell do this in such an immediate way? We need to start at the point of entry of smell sensation into the brain. the odor receptors in the upper nasal passages that recognize different scent chemicals. The scent chemicals may be found in food that is tasted, a madeleine, an herb, or maybe airborne, the scent of cut grass, a lupin. The spark plug of memory. At a molecular level, the specific pairing of an odor molecule to its matched odor receptor in the nasal passages triggers an electronic signal that is carried to the brain in a very short nerve, about 2 inches long, called the olfactory nerve. The olfactory nerve runs horizontally from the back of the nose to a structure in the brain called the amygdala. I call the amygdala the emotional spark plug of the brain, because it triggers emotional responses and feelings. It is situated directly in front of the hippocampus, with which it is densely interconnected, and into which the amygdala weaves its emotional synapses. When neurons link up, they form cell assemblies that fire together, forming the basis for emotional memory. The emotional spark plug of memory, the amygdala, like the hippocampus, is plastic and can easily grow connections called synapses to other neurons. Also, like the hippocampus, it has direct connection with the sensory regions of the cerebral cortex, in particular the visual cortex, facilitating emotional response to imagery. But the sense of smell is special. The difference between smell and the other four sensations, vision, hearing, touch, and taste, is that smell neurons from the nose get to the amygdala first, thanks to the short run from the nasal passages. This is why we experience an immediacy of emotion when we smell. Other sensory experiences relay through the cortex on the surface of the brain before diving down to the amygdala and the hippocampus. Something is seen before you feel the associated memory. You hear a song before you remember the summer when it was a hit. Smell neurons, by first relaying to the amygdala, trigger feelings before the smell can be consciously identified. Smell, as Proust described it, is remembered as a feeling. It is amazing that through intense introspection, he could pinpoint this subjective phenomenal experience before it could be explained by science. In my case, the Lovitch molecules had triggered a signal in the nasal passages that had traveled to the amygdala, causing a remembrance of a feeling of nausea. Meanwhile, the image of the sunlit Lovitch was shimmering on my visual cortex. The remembered nausea and the identification of the smell, the visual identification of the Lovitch and the memory of the salad came together, and the knowledge that the Lovitch had made me sick emerged from the neuronal mix. And we have a couple of little side comments here. Some scented candles are made specifically to smell like the emotion-evoking moments of life. Fragrances often include mistletoe, crab apples, and the saltiness of the beach. Memory hack on the scent of a memory. Sometimes your deepest and most stirring memories reside not in the mental image of a particular person, place, or period, but in the special scent you associate with. Deliberately exposing yourself to those meaningful scents can be a way to help mentally carry yourself back in time. To practice this exercise, go to a place that evokes the aromas associated with meaningful life memories. It could be a busy ethnic market, relaxing beach, noisy stadium, or a beloved hot dog stand. Inhale the aromas around you. Notice whether you associate any olfactory delights with a former lover, friend, family member, or other significant person from your past. Take a few moments to appreciate the qualities of the scents you experience. Close your eyes and let spontaneous images rush in. Immerse yourself in any memories evoked by the scent, as deeply and emotionally as you can. Does the experience trigger a meaningful flashback? Does your mind fill with images of people and scenes from your past? Allow yourself to give in to the emotional responses and the feelings you had when a certain scent was part of your daily life. When you feel ready, open your eyes and find a quiet place to sit. Consider how certain scents sometimes trigger associations to the past. As you go about your day, tune into the scents associated with the people, places, and things around you. Let any memories they evoke wash over you. Now on to AARP, the magazine. And this particular issue of the magazine has a lot of information in it and short stories as opposed to longer ones. So let's look at Gene Chatsky to the rescue and the financial money saver part. Torn between two mortgages, a careful couple find themselves short on cash. They're ready to borrow against their home's value. But how? The problem. The subject line in an email I received from Chris Oletti, 71, a medical assistant, and her husband Bob, 72, a retired cement contractor, read, "House poor." But they shouldn't have been. They had made smart financial decisions and held $150,000 in retirement savings. They received $2,500 a month in Social Security. Chris still earned about $3,000 a month, and they lived modestly, no credit card debt, and a car payment of just $200. The albatross? Their $1,500 mortgage payment. And they needed about $50,000 in renovations to age in place. What to do? "Bankers tell us to refinance," they wrote. "A reverse mortgage company will try to sway us toward a reverse mortgage. Please help." The advice. Listening to Chris and Bob, I was sure that they faced another issue along with their question about borrowing, cash flow management. Over the years, I've done a number of what TV producers call money makeovers, which often revolve around helping people spend less, save more, and pay down debt. So I start with a direct order. Track your spending, every penny, for a month. In our first call, Chris and Bob laid out their spending in incredible detail. $30 a month on a dental policy, for example, $80 on water and sewage, and $15 on the newspaper. But the modest spending they described seemed out of sync with the straits they were in, so I told them to track. Within 2 weeks, Chris had the aha moment I had seen before. "I have been tracking expenditures, and it's amazing to see how some of them just seem to get forgotten," she wrote. "The culprits were common ones. Food, we take our grandsons out to eat, and online shopping. Just being conscious of these spending leaks," I explained, "would help the couple shut them down." That brought us to their house, which they valued at about $425,000. Refinancing their $210,000 mortgage and pulling out cash was possible, and would even trim their monthly payment by about $150 a month, thanks to low interest rates. But they would still be left with the mortgage payment that was dragging them down. A reverse mortgage would eliminate the payment. They were wary of a reverse mortgage, though. Closing costs would run nearly $20,000. But they decided to apply for one and go through the independent counseling process mandated by HUD. The counselor went over everything in detail, Chris said. The couple would still have to pay taxes and insurance, and if they fell behind, they could well lose their home, and the loan would have to be repaid if they moved out for more than a year. "It's more counseling than when you buy an actual home," she said. The outcome. The couple decided to go with the reverse mortgage. Their timing was good. Their home appraised for $600,000, and then low interest rates helped boost their loan amount. Out of the $336,000 reverse mortgage proceeds, $210,000 paid off their conventional mortgage, and $18,000 covered their closing costs, leaving them with a $108,000 line of credit, some of which they'll use to renovate the kitchen. The biggest relief, Chris explained, is not having a mortgage payment. The bank gets paid in full plus interest when the house is sold. They'll still have to pay property tax and home insurance bills, however. As for tracking expenses, it's a habit they're keeping, especially as Chris looks to retire soon. the everyday expenses, telephone, television, gas, work clothes. I've even played out how these things are going to change when I'm not commuting 45 miles a day, she says. We feel pretty secure. Now let's change subjects. You asked, we answered. Based on AARP's exclusive survey on health and aging, these are the questions. Can my back be fixed? Do keto diets really work? Is cancer inevitable? Is walking enough? Is my heart okay? Why am I so tired? Will my libido ever come back? Should I try fasting? Which vitamins? You told us exactly what health concerns worry you most. We dug into the science and consulted the experts to answer your questions and to help you live longer, healthier, and happier. So this is starting on another health adventure here. A funny thing happened as we march into our 60s. Life starts to feel sweeter. That's what you told us in an AARP survey of 900 older adults, Americans, this year, this past winter. We 60-somethings have a pretty optimistic view of our physical and mental health. There's a reason for this. Researchers have evidence that as people get older, they become more positive, said Manfred Diehl, a professor of human development and family studies at Colorado State University, who researches psychology and aging. But that doesn't mean you don't need to pay attention to what your body is telling you and search out authoritative answers when something doesn't feel right. So we collated the results of our wellness survey with other data, consulted the top experts, and checked out the most up-to-date research. And we boiled it down to find some real solutions to the real problems that are gnawing at our 60-something minds, and I assume 80 and 90-something minds as well. First, we look at eating well, living well. I'm in my 60s, but honestly, I feel like I'm still young. Isn't that the definition of good health? Sure, but longevity researchers study a phenomenon known as future time perspective. The more time we perceive we have, the more we're able to ignore the fact that we're overweight, may have elevated inflammation levels, and don't know what our basic health numbers look like. If you haven't had a checkup in the past year, start there. Get your blood pressure, blood glucose, and cholesterol numbers checked, and make sure that keeping them under control is a top priority. Number two, wait, I heard doctors don't worry so much about cholesterol anymore. Is that true? No. High cholesterol, particularly LDL or bad cholesterol, is still a marker for a higher risk for heart disease. And preliminary results from a 2022 study of more than 750 older adults found a link between high cholesterol levels and elevated dementia risk. So stick with those statins if that's what your physician suggests. 3. Does all this healthy living stuff really help me live longer? My uncle ate bacon every morning and lived to 87. It's not just about how long you live, it's about how well you live. A 2019 BMJ, British Medical Journal, study that had followed more than 110,000 people since the 80s showed that those who adopted healthy lifestyle habits, such as controlling their weight, exercising, and not smoking, lived free of major chronic diseases far longer after age 50, 30 plus years, than did people who didn't adopt those habits, 23 years. Science still hasn't explained Keith Richards, however. Number 4. Okay, I'm in. So what's the best anti-aging diet? Keto? Paleo? G-free? Do I need to live on acai and buttered coffee? Healthy food rules number 1. No fad diets, no weird plans, just common sense. According to a 2022 data analysis in the journal PLOS Medicine, making simple dietary changes, for instance, eating more legumes, nuts, whole grains, fruits, and vegetables, and eating less red and processed meats, extended life expectancy. Switching to an optimal diet at age 60 could add 8 years of life for women and as many as 9 for men. Foods like sugar and highly processed flour can trigger inflammation in your body and are usually calorie dense as well, says Marianne Walsh, a certified diabetes educator and the founder of Walsh Nutritional Counseling. Number 5, I've heard that keeping calories down is linked to longevity. Does that mean fasting? Multiple studies have shown that long-term calorie reduction can reduce metabolic function and slow the cellular aging process in rats. Human trials have been limited. A 2019 study in The Lancet found that people who reduced their calorie intake by 12% had lower blood pressure and cholesterol, increased insulin sensitivity, and lower inflammation. The problem? The study covered only 238 people over 2 years, and the oldest among them was 50. Plus, calorie restriction diets can cause muscle loss, which in turn can result in rebound weight gain and other unhealthy outcomes. Your best bet, don't fast and don't go on crash diets. Just try to eliminate the junk calories you eat and turn to more healthy foods, especially fruits and veggies. A good starting point is to reduce snacking out of boredom, anxiety, or habit. Instead, stretch or take a walk. So a sidebar says, I know what I'm supposed to eat, but how can I keep eating what I enjoy? In most cases, you can eat anything you want. Walsh observes, you just can't eat as much of it as you want. And you have to include the fruits, vegetables, nuts, legumes, whole grains, and fish you need to lower inflammation and keep your calories in check. Well, we're going to stop there for this article, and we'll continue next time because it does go on at great length. And let's sneak in a few more tips on saving money from AARP, the Bulletin. Seal and insulate your ducts. Use mastic or foil-backed tape to reseal all the joints in your HVAC ducts. Then wrap bat insulation around any duct sections in unheated and or uncooled locations. You'll save up to $120 a year, says the Environmental Protection Agency. And listen to your kids. Scope out estate sales. Don't buy jewelry, furnishings, or tools new. Go to estate sales instead. You'll frequently find top-quality stuff, often just lightly used, and sometimes at crazy low prices. Many now also offer online auctions. Well, folks, we've run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure and listen at the same time next week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call 919-832-5138. Again, 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.